Shrink Wrap Radio number 45, August 6, 2006, Drugs and Psychotherapy. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
And so they take the drugs that were designed for adults and they give them to kids. And that's completely legal for a doctor, any MD, to do that. Once a drug is FDA approved, the doctor can prescribe that drug for anything, and actually any doctor can prescribe any drug for anything. For example, the gynecologist can prescribe antidepressants completely legally. So once a drug is FDA approved, the doctor can give it to a kid, even though it was never tested on kids. And then what happens is we wait and see what side effects show up and get reported back. And if enough of them show up and get reported back to the FDA, the FDA might put what's called a black box warning on the drug to say to people things like, many kids get suicidal when they take this drug, but it's only after the fact.
That was the voice of Dr. Padma Kattel, author of Drugs and Clients, What Every Psychotherapist Needs to Know. According to the book's flyleaf, Drugs and Clients is written for people who are studying or practicing the art of psychotherapy, particularly marriage and family therapists, clinical social workers, nurses, graduate students, school counselors, and psychologists, all of whom have a need to know how prescription psychoactive medications and other mind-altering drugs, both legal and illegal, affect their clients. Dr. Kattel is a professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies, a licensed psychologist, and a marriage and family therapist. She also has a BA in biology from Hunter College and an MA in biology from the City University of New York with a specialization in pharmacology, which she studied at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. She's been teaching psychopharmacology at the California Institute of Integral Studies and other graduate schools in the San Francisco Bay Area since 1984. Her advanced degrees in both biology and psychology, combined with her extensive teaching and clinical experience, make Dr. Kattel uniquely qualified to understand and address the problems facing today's psychotherapists in this rapidly changing, controversial, and increasingly important area of psychology. I got together with Dr. Kattel for an in-person interview. Generally, that makes for better sound quality. However, I guess Dr. Dave is still figuring out his new Eterol digital recorder because there's a lot of ambient room noise. So I apologize for the less than stellar sound quality. I promise it will get better. Now, on to the interview. Hi, Padma. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, Dave.
I have been reading your book and enjoying it, Drugs and Clients, What Every Psychotherapist Needs to Know. What motivated you to write the book?
Oh, I've been teaching psychopharmacology to psychology students for 22 years now. And I realized that most of the books on psychopharmacology were written for MD psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. And there was very, very little available for therapists, psychologists, or even people who are interested in that topic that was accessible in terms of the information. And I felt like I really wanted to write it for my students and for other therapists to be able to have something appropriate to their level of what they needed to know as not as a prescribing MD. Mm-hmm. So there was just nothing out there.
Yeah, now, I would have expected a book, in fact, like this to be written by a medical doctor, but you're a psychologist. Mm-hmm. So how is it that you have the expertise to do this?
Oh, before I was a psychologist, I was a scientist.
Oh.
I was very interested in the psychopharmacology of the brain. And so when I was in graduate school, I studied molecular biology. But the part of molecular biology I was interested in was all about the central nervous system and how it worked. Mm-hmm. And so that was in the 60s, when people were very into exploring consciousness also.
Right.
And I was very curious about that too, about how all these drugs were changing people's consciousness, but I was curious about it on a molecular biology level.
Good for you.
And so I started studying this topic then, and really have maintained my interest over the last over 40 years. And then I became a psychologist. I switched from being a scientist to a psychologist because I felt like I wanted more direct contact with human beings. Mm-hmm. I was working with viruses, and it wasn't that rewarding to me. And I wanted more reward from my work. I went back to school and got a PhD in psychology. Mm-hmm. And then I essentially had the perfect background because of knowing pharmacology and knowing psychology to put these together into Psychopharm.
Yeah, what a great background, really a fairly unique background, and it fills a need, you know, a niche that I don't think had been addressed before. Now, from the subtitle, What Every Psychotherapist Needs to Know, it would seem that you aimed the book at a fairly narrow audience, which is to say psychotherapists. What about non-therapists? Were they intended to be part of the target audience as well?
Well, at all? As I said, I really wrote the book because there was a need for students and therapists to have a book that was really directed towards them because as professionals, they're in contact with people who are on a lot of medications. Mm-hmm. I hope, and I have been told, that the book is written in a way that's accessible. It's clear, it's not jargony. That's accessible to anyone who's interested in it.
Yeah, it's also not a big fat tome, which listeners might imagine when we're talking about a topic like this. They might be imagining something really thick. It's paperback and about, do you remember how many pages?
I think it's about 230 pages. Yeah. I don't know if that includes the appendices and the index.
Right.
But it's pretty readable font and, you know, it's not very verbose in any way.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we had talked earlier about would this type of a book have any interest for general listeners, and you pointed out that so many people are on psychoactive medications these days. Do you have any figures on that? You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I can tell you my guess. The reason it's hard to know exactly the numbers is twofold. I think many people don't mention that they're on psychoactive drugs. Mm-hmm. And there's no survey that I know of that's ever been done. And when you think about psychoactive drugs, when I think about psychoactive drugs, I don't only think about prescription medication, which, of course, I think, I'll tell you my opinion, I think that probably in the United States, from talking to my students and clients, about one-third of people are on some kind of psychoactive drug.
Okay.
But when I say psychoactive drug, well, I want to say two things at once. When I say psychoactive drug, I mean anything that helps you sleep, anything that is for pain, mm-hmm. any kind of herbal drug that is for anxiety, to calm you down, okay. or any of those things, in my mind, are psychoactive drugs.
Right.
Aside from all the prescription drugs.
Yeah.
And then there's caffeine and nicotine.
Okay.
And if I add those, probably I should raise it to at least 50% of people are on some kind of, higher.
Maybe nearly everybody. So maybe a very large proportion of my audience, of you listeners out there, will find this relevant information, mm-hmm. since so many of us are on drugs of one sort or another. Even as you point out, things like alcohol, nicotine, caffeine, these are drugs as well.
Yes, I didn't mention alcohol, though there's a whole chapter on alcohol,
okay.
in my book.
Yeah.
And then there's a chapter on stimulants, which includes cocaine, amphetamines, drugs of abuse are in there too, mm-hmm. Caffeine, and nicotine.
All of this in just 230-some pages. Amazing. Now, do you think that psychoactive medications are overprescribed?
Well, it's a really hard question. What I think is that every drug that we take, we have to realize there's a trade-off between the benefits that you get from the drug and the side effects or the downside
right.
of the drug, every single drug. So I think what has happened now is that particularly the antidepressant medications have gotten so safe, or I should say, so much safer than they used to be,
okay.
that people who have milder depressions, a psychiatrist or a general practice doctor, feels much more comfortable prescribing those drugs than they did in the past when the drugs were much less safe.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be that someone had to be really severely depressed for the doctor to want to take the risk to give them the drugs.
Right.
Now, if people have mild depression, the doctor will give them the drugs because the risk is much less. So overprescribed is a hard question. In other words, the downside, the side effects with antidepressants have become so much less that people are, many, many more people are taking them than they used to.
Yes.
Overprescribed, the way I view it is people, in my opinion, to use a should, people shouldn't take drugs unless they can't function well without the drugs because of the side effects.
Mm-hmm.
Folks don't think about the side effects, but they're always there.
Right.
So if you can function without the drugs and be okay, have a productive life, go to work or take care of your kids, whatever you do, and you don't need the drugs, I say try to manage without the drugs. Use exercise, do yoga, get more rest,
mm-hmm.
look at what's stressing you out or depressing you,
mm-hmm.
and see if you can change it that way. If you can't manage your life, then I think the drugs for depression in particular are relatively benign nowadays. And that's why so many people are choosing to ask for them and take them.
Okay, you've opened up the topic of depression, and that is one that I wanted to get to. So let's talk about it a little bit more, if we can. I know years ago at the University of Pennsylvania, which is one of my alma maters, there was a study suggesting that cognitive behavioral therapy was as effective as antidepressant medication. So I'm wondering, you know, what's the state of the art today in relation to depression?
Mm-hmm. It is still believed that cognitive behavioral therapy is the best psychological treatment
okay.
for depression, but the studies have shown, and people have looked at this quite a bit, that if someone has a more severe depression, that the optimal treatment is the combination of medication and psychotherapy.
Uh-huh.
So that a person could take medication alone, have psychotherapy alone, but the combination sort of contributes different things to someone's
yeah.
feeling better.
Yeah.
So it's still believed that cognitive therapy is the best therapy for depression.
Okay. I know there's stereotypes out there. At least I think there are stereotypes. Like, I think there's a stereotype about psychiatrists that they are just going to prescribe some kind of a drug, and it's going to be wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, 15-minute interview, update your meds, and send you on your way. That's kind of the stereotype of the psychiatrist. The stereotype of the non-medical therapist is that this person is really opposed to any kind of medication at all and will do everything they can to advise people. Well, they probably wouldn't take the risk of actually advising against it, because they could get sued for that. But, where do you see this? Where's the balance? What's reality in terms of practice today among psychiatrists and psychotherapists as you know it?
Well, things have changed, I think, very dramatically over the last 20 years
okay.
from when I started teaching this class in schools until now. And I really see it reflected in my students who are learning to be therapists. But the factors are that a lot of what happens is controlled by our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many psychiatrists who would like to be doing psychotherapy. But because of the way they get reimbursed by the insurance companies and health maintenance organizations, they are essentially paid to dispense the drugs and get the people out of there more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So they have changed from 20 years ago. Very few psychiatrists wanted to only do the med prescribing and not the therapy.
Uh-huh.
They wanted to do both.
Yeah.
Nowadays, very few of them do the therapy. They just do the prescribing. And that has to do with changes that have happened in our healthcare system.
Interesting.
Yes. Psychotherapists, MFTs, psychiatric nurses, people who are doing the treatment, LCSWs, have also changed. So 20 years ago, I would say it was absolutely right that the therapist types really were anti-drug.
Right.
And I had to really kind of convince people that it was okay sometimes to encourage their clients to go get a med evaluation. It's really changed dramatically now because so many people are on drugs. So in the general population and in my students, people themselves, students themselves, and their friends and family members are often on some kind of psychoactive drug. And so the stigma has really been taken away from the idea that we really should only use therapy. So the therapists are now much more open to the idea of drugs being appropriate in some ways. And the psychiatrists are doing therapy much less because of financial reimbursement issues.
Yeah, right.
Yes. And most of the time, unfortunately, I want to speak about this in a minute, psychoactive drugs are dispensed by family practice doctors. I've even had people come to me to tell me that their gynecologist gave them antidepressants because they looked a little down the last two times they went to the gynecologist. Mm-hmm. This is an actual case. And the gynecologist said, oh, the drug rep was by and gave me these samples and I'm going to give them to you. Why don't you try them? I am very opposed to people who don't know about psychoactive drugs giving out psychoactive drugs. And that's all because of health maintenance insurance issues.
Yes.
And because the drugs, antidepressants, have gotten safer. So doctors who really have no expertise feel much more comfortable handing them out than they did before.
Yeah.
So it's a complex picture of what's going on with that right now.
What about all the kids that are on medications these days? How do you feel about that? I know I see articles in popular magazines and newspapers. What are your feelings about that? What are some of the issues that are involved?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some mysteries going on with kids. Many, many more kids are now being diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. Nobody really knows why. So folks have looked at, well, are there more kids getting diagnosed now because they're going into the doctor more and people are more aware of attention deficit, and so they're getting the proper diagnosis? Are there more children who now have attention deficit because of preservatives in our food or various things we're breathing in or eating? Or is this just a phenomenon where the teachers want the kids to keep quiet so they are not a problem in the classroom and they just want to give them meds? So for whatever reason, still is mysterious, many, many more kids are getting diagnosed with attention deficit disorder.
Right.
And the trend at the moment, and psychiatric diagnoses go through trends.
Isn't that interesting?
And the trend at the moment is bipolar disorder, both for adults and children.
Uh-huh.
So you'll hear more and more people saying they have bipolar disorder or their kid has bipolar disorder than ever before.
That's true. When I was teaching, I would have students come up and tell me they have bipolar disorder.
Yes.
And you never used to hear that.
That's right. So they go through different trends. It had been borderline personality disorder for a while.
Oh, yes.
And it had been multiple personality disorder for a while. But bipolar disorder is what's kind of in now. And that's just the whole field. Anyway, what people are thinking is that a lot of children who have been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder actually have bipolar disorder, but that the symptoms in children look different than they do in adults.
Okay.
And instead of manic episodes, the kids get agitated and angry.
Mm-hmm.
And kids get agitated and angry. And so it's very difficult to diagnose kids. And then the question is, if a kid has attention deficit disorder or bipolar disorder, what do you do about medication with this young person?
Yeah.
And some of the problems are that the drugs for bipolar disorder most drugs are not tested on children. Drugs mostly are not tested on children, pregnant women, or the elderly, because of a whole variety of reasons which would complicate the results.
Okay.
So drugs are mostly tested on healthy people who are not taking any other medications.
Mm-hmm.
between the ages of, say, 25 and 45.
So that creates some real problems, doesn't it? Because you test it on healthy, normal people, you don't really know what the effect is going to be on the child or the elderly.
That's exactly correct. Now, of course, certain drugs that were really designed for kids or for the elderly are tested on those populations. But the drugs for bipolar disorder, which is what we're thinking about, mm-hmm. are not designed for kids. And so they take the drugs that were designed for adults and they give them to kids. And that's completely legal for a doctor, any MD, to do that. Once a drug is FDA approved, the doctor can prescribe that drug for anything.
Right.
And actually, any doctor can prescribe any drug for anything. For example, the gynecologist can prescribe antidepressants completely legally. So once a drug is FDA approved, the doctor can give it to a kid, even though it was never tested on kids. And then what happens is we wait and see what side effects show up and get reported back. And if enough of them show up and get reported back to the FDA might put what's called a black box warning on the drug to say to people things like, many kids get suicidal when they take this drug, but it's only after the fact.
It sounds very trial and error, hit and miss.
It is very trial and error, hit and miss.
Wow.
Yeah.
Kind of like we're experimenting, we're using our children as guinea pigs to some degree.
Yeah. And the other side, again, is if the kid is out of control or the kid can't really learn anything in school or is alienating all their friends with their behavior, you have to think, is that damaging the kid more than the unknown damage of taking
right.
a drug?
Right.
So it's always that risk-benefit mm-hmm. idea that I think people have to keep in mind. And we don't like to think about the risk part.
Yeah.
We're more clear on the benefit part.
Well, is there any advantage to, before they were classified as ADD, now they're classified as bipolar, do we get some extra treatment leverage in that shift?
I'm not sure what you mean by treatment leverage.
Well, are we able to treat them more effectively?
Well, the idea is that they might respond to different medication if they have ADD than if they have bipolar disorder.
Yeah, and there's some evidence to support that?
There is. They had some children diagnosed. I mean, many children were diagnosed with ADD, but were not improving on the drugs
okay.
designed for ADD
okay.
and are improving on the drugs for bipolar disorder. Now, it gets very complicated because most of the drugs for bipolar disorder are very sedating drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a kid who's hyperactive and you give them a drug that's sedating, they will calm down.
Right, right. So,
you know,
yeah.
So you have to think, and nobody knows what the effects will be on the kids in the long run.
Yeah. I don't know if you can answer this question or not, but I'm wondering, when is it appropriate to take a psychoactive medication and when not? You know, certainly that's something the doctor has mm-hmm. to figure out, but also we live in an era when patients are driving more and more of their own care. So how's a poor patient to figure that out,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether or not maybe they should be on a psychoactive substance or not?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it would be a good idea to talk to somebody like a psychiatrist or a psychologist or some kind of counselor if you're even thinking of that, because usually people don't like to take medication in general.
Mm-hmm.
We would rather not take medication. People have a lot of value judgments about being dependent on drugs. There's fear of getting addicted to drugs. So usually if somebody says, I'm thinking I might want to take medication, it means they're troubled enough by something that it merits a little bit more investigation. I like guidelines like try therapy. See if, we're talking about depression, anxiety. We can talk a little bit about sleep problems and things like that, pain. I would say talk to a professional and talk it over with them. Say, I'm thinking I might need medication, and let someone with that kind of expertise assess it with you. Generally speaking, in my practice, I like to treat people for a little while, like a month, and see if they improve with just psychotherapy. If they're improving and they're not suicidal or something really severe, then probably they don't need drugs.
Okay.
If they're not improving and not functioning in their life, it might be a good idea for them to meet with a psychiatrist mm-hmm. and get an expert evaluation. The one thing I want to say is sometimes it's difficult to evaluate research because a lot of the research is sponsored by the drug companies.
Right.
And they want to sell drugs. Mm-hmm. And I read the drug research constantly. There's tons of it all the time, and I read it.
Oh, good for you.
But it's sometimes hard to assess. But what I want to say is there is some evidence with certain mental disorders, depression and bipolar disorder, that if they go on for a long time and they're not treated, they start to cause other deficits, intellectual deficits, mm-hmm. memory problems that are caused by having the disorder. Uh-huh. So psychiatrists will say, you don't want that to happen. You'd rather give a person a drug than have them get the cognitive losses by not being treated.
So in other words, it might not be a good idea to tough it out, as I think so often we have picked up that advice one place or another, the sense that, well, we should just tough it out and keep a stiff upper lip, that actually if you're very depressed, that could lead to additional problems.
Exactly, and I don't think many people realize that. Both bipolar disorder and depression, actually, and psychosis, mm-hmm. there's evidence of cognitive losses if folks aren't treated.
Wow, that's news to me. Yeah. So I'm glad to learn that.
Yeah.
Yeah, in this age of self-treatment, I think often people make decisions about medications themselves, maybe without consulting with their physician. Maybe they've got some old stuff laying around that they decide to start taking again, or they decide to stop something suddenly that was prescribed. I know years ago I was given a prescription for Valium, and it had to do with some stomach problems I was having at the time. But then I had a paradoxical reaction to it. I got high on it rather than getting more and more calm, and I began to behave irresponsibly. I wasn't aware of it, actually. People that knew me had to tell me this. It kind of triggered a manic episode in me. And so I quit, and I quit all at once. And I've since learned you're not supposed to do that. I went into a deep depression, as a result of just trying to go cold turkey all of a sudden.
Well, that I think what you're saying is absolutely true. People take each other's drugs. People take their partner's drugs, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. they decide to try it. And, of course, then they have no medical supervision whatsoever at all.
Right.
What you reminded me of is the use nowadays of herbal and over-the-counter medications mm-hmm. to treat various psychological problems, depression, certainly sleep problems,
right.
energy problems. And people have no medical guidance for that. There's very little research done or even available on most herbal mm-hmm. preparations because nobody wants to pay for it. And see, a drug company, when they pay for the research, they're going to make a lot of money
right.
after they do that.
Sure.
Well, you can't patent herbal remedies in the same way.
Yeah.
So they're not going to make a lot of money.
Right.
So they don't want to spend, well, the latest figures I have is it costs almost $1 billion to get a drug to market nowadays.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, certainly, an herbal company is not going to want to spend that money. They'll never recoup that money.
Right.
So, therefore, no one pays for the research. Therefore, the research isn't available. Therefore, the information isn't available. So, when you're talking about taking things without supervision, I think, in terms of herbal preparations, that's the largest. No one can tell you, even an MD, even a pharmacologist, what those drugs are going to do. But then we have the whole arena that you said, which is that people take each other's drugs. People take drugs without supervision. And I'm pretty strict. I think a psychiatrist should be monitoring people's drug mm-hmm. taking. And then they have guidelines for how to taper you off a drug, how long. There are real written guidelines for how long someone with a depression should stay on a drug before they start tapering it off to see if they're going to be okay without it.
Right. Right. So I really want my listeners to take in this learning that came to me the hard way. Don't just go cold turkey. Do consult with mm-hmm. your psychiatrist or physician before you make a decision on your own to just stop.
Someone, or at least, you know, you can go online nowadays and get information about stopping drugs.
Right. And even your book, would your book have information of that sort or not?
It definitely has that kind of information.
Good.
It even tells you the guidelines of how many months someone should be on an antidepressant before they even attempt to get off it.
Okay.
Because antidepressants, contrary to most popular belief, antidepressants actually start to work pretty quickly. They may not reach their maximum benefit for 6 weeks or 8 weeks,
yeah, that's what they say.
But people start to feel better in a day or two.
Oh.
But one should not stop the antidepressant just because you're feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
The guideline is 6 months of feeling better before you start to taper off of it.
Okay.
So my book discusses that with regard to antidepressants, with regard to sedative drugs like Valium, Ambien,
yeah,
very commonly taken. About the dangers of going off the drugs too quickly.
I better go read your book some more. I don't want to make too many confessions here, but
I want to make one statement since many people may listen to this. The drugs that are most dangerous to come off rapidly are drugs that have sedating qualities, like alcohol, if you drink every day, or if you have a problem with drinking, and drugs like Valium or sleep preparations. Those categories of drugs, quick withdrawal, can be fatal.
Mm.
You definitely need a doctor's supervision.
Okay. Well,
okay. Those are the main ones that need doctor's supervision.
Good. I'm glad you got that.
I wanted to say that. Yes.
Right. Now we've mentioned that your book covers substances like alcohol, caffeine, nicotine, and herbs. Let's talk about a couple of these. Caffeine, for example. I've only recently started to drink coffee. I grew up thinking it was bad for you. But then my wife kept showing me newspaper articles suggesting the opposite. So what's the scoop on caffeine?
Well, it's very interesting. There's been a lot of news in the last year or two which really prove that, with a couple of exceptions, and I'll tell you them in a minute, that caffeine, drinking coffee, because the studies that I've seen show a difference between consuming caffeine in tea or coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So the main study, the largest study that was done in Japan, they compared tea, green tea, coffee with caffeine, and decaf coffee. And the effects were that people who drank at least 2 cups of regular coffee a day were protected in terms of had a much less frequent occurrence of liver cancer than people who drank green tea.
Mm.
Green tea has other benefits.
Right.
So I'm not speaking about that, but with regard to that, so they show that caffeine, coffee, had that benefit. And most recently, they're showing that drinking coffee is protective against a type 2 diabetes in some way.
Mm-hmm.
In our population, the world, as we all are gaining weight, type 2 diabetes is becoming more and more prevalent.
Yes.
And they're showing that coffee protects people from that. And actually, with a type 2 diabetes, the more coffee you drink, the more you are protected.
Yeah, that's great. But then there are probably some things on the other side, right?
Oh, yes.
There are probably some problems with coffee.
Well, there are really only two main conditions that people want to think about whether or not they drink coffee. One is heart conditions, because caffeine is a stimulant. It stimulates your heart.
Okay.
Makes your heart beat faster. There's no two ways about it. So if you have heart problems, I would certainly check with my doctor or avoid caffeine. And fibrocystic breast disease in women, where they have pain and tenderness in their breasts, particularly before their periods, caffeine makes that condition worse. Other than that, there seem to be and anxiety, of course, general anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
If you're an anxious person, one of the first things I would ask my clients if they come in complaining of anxiety is how much caffeine and other stimulants
mm-hmm.
they consume. Because sometimes having a client stop drinking coffee takes away their anxiety disorder.
Or drinking a lot of Coke, right?
Absolutely. Anything that can do, Dr. Peppers, these bolt. Jolts and
bolts.
Yeah,
now they've got sort of really amped up
exactly, Red Bull, exactly. Anything with caffeine.
And I think kids gravitate towards those because it's sort of almost like a pseudo-alcohol. You know, it's like, something with some kick.
Well, it gives us a high.
Yeah.
We like stimulants.
Yeah.
And caffeine is definitely a stimulant.
We like stimulants.
Yeah.
Maybe that should be our closing line here.
I just want to say one thing about caffeine, which is interesting about kids. There's been some research that show that kids with attention deficit disorder is often treated by giving the kid stimulants. And there's been some research that giving a kid caffeine, coffee, treats some kids with attention deficit disorder without having to give them other drugs. And as we've just said, coffee is not a drug that has a lot of side effects if you don't have a heart condition or fibrocystic breast disease, and kids won't have either of those.
Yeah, interesting.
So they have a paradoxical reaction to the caffeine.
Yeah. Well, boy, you're a wealth of information, and there are a lot of other topics that I would love to interview you about, and perhaps down the line we can get together again to do that. Before I let you go, is there anything else that you'd like to say that maybe I didn't think to ask you about?
Well, I guess just that people need to remember that there's always a risk-benefit to taking any kind of drug, an aspirin, doesn't matter what kind of drug it is, and that it'd be good to inform yourself about what the risks are and what the benefits are before you make a decision about taking anything.
Right. I noticed there's so many commercials on, particularly during the news. The news seems to be aimed at my age group, and they advertise just a ton of different pharmaceutical products. And, you know, they show people dancing through the wind at the beach and how wonderful and flowing it all is. And then at the end, they run through this list of side effects. Your nose may fall off and blah, blah, blah. and they're just horrible side effects. But they just kind of run through them very quickly. I'm going to put a link to your book in our show notes. And just as we close here, I'm wondering if there's a book that stands out for you as having had a major impact on either your personal life or your professional career. I know I'm springing this on you unexpectedly. What's been the big book for you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm kind of an avid reader. It's a really hard question. I think really if I want to say a book that has influenced me the most, I would say the Tao Te Ching has influenced me the most as one book in terms of how to live and how to be in the world.
What a great recommendation. Padma, thanks so much. You can consider yourself shrunk and wrapped.
Thank you, Dave.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Padma Katel. As you heard me mention in the interview, drugs can sometimes have surprising effects. Most people find that Valium makes them very calm and relaxed. As I report in the interview, I was prescribed Valium many years ago for a stomach ailment. Far from sedating me, it had the paradoxical effect of gradually making me irresponsibly manic. Here's one of the stories that I can tell from that episode. It's a cautionary tale about the possible unexpected psychological effects of prescription drugs. Keep in mind that these events took place a long, long time ago and bear no relation whatsoever to the underlying psychodynamics of Dr. Dave. So once again, we step behind the curtain to discover that the Great Oz is in fact none other than the Amazing Whitman.
The Amazing Whitman.
I'm in Florida with the family on a visit to the in-laws. It's very, very boring. I've been reading an autobiographical book by the amazing Preskin, a well-known show business entertainer, a mentalist, in fact. I'm so inspired by his rise to success that it suddenly occurs to me that I could be a famous stage hypnotist. In a blinding flash of originality, I decide my stage name will be The Amazing Whitman, Whitman being my middle name. The nearest city to my in-laws is Orlando. I take out the phone book and start calling nightclubs and hotel lounges. I explain that I'm a psychologist and a professor with a clinical and research background in hypnosis, and that I'm now launching my career as a stage hypnotist. In order to build up my entertainment resume, I will perform in their venue this very weekend for free. to get a nibble from the lounge at the Ramada Inn. The guy suggests I come in and talk with him this very afternoon. Terrific. I have no car with me in Florida, but my mood is too high for that minor detail to present much of an impediment. For some reason, my in-laws won't loan me their car, so I stick out my thumb and hitchhike to Orlando, which is an hour or so away. I'm picked up by a very nice guy, and I tell him I'm going to be performing later that night at the Ramada Inn. He promises to bring his girlfriend and catch the act. It's midday when I arrive at the Ramada Inn. I find the guy I had spoken with on the phone. He's in a very small office. I notice a baseball bat on the desk, and I believe I also see a revolver. He shows me the lounge, and it's a sleepy-looking place. Nobody there. He tells me there's a band performing later tonight, but he can squeeze me in during their intermission. Since my show will be late and I have no car, I'm able to negotiate for a free night's stay there at the Ramada. He also tells me that he has a buddy who is a talent agent and just happens to be at the bar. So he takes me over to the bar, and there's this guy hanging over the edges of a bar stool who must be 350 pounds at least, and he has a gaggle of hot blonde babes hanging all over him. This is a scene straight out of The Sopranos, and I'm beginning to suspect that I'm in mafia world. Turns out his name is Rocco, and something Italian for the last name. I'm introduced to him as the amazing Whitman. He sticks his thumb out in front of my face, and his first words to me are, "Hey, Whitman, hypnotize my thumb." Even flying high on Valium, I'm stupefied, totally stumped for a snappy comeback. Somehow we get past this conversational gambit, and he assures me he'll catch my act later tonight, and then he'll let me know whether he can line up more work for me. Somehow, I hitchhike back to the in-laws, get gussied up for my performance, leaving the family slack-jawed, and manage to catch a ride back into Orlando. When I arrive back at the Ramada Inn, it's nighttime. In fact, it's a weekend night, and I'm horrified to discover that the sleepy little lounge of earlier that afternoon turns out to be the swinging singles hotspot of Orlando, Florida. A loud, hard rock band is tearing up the place. There are two bars, each thronged three deep with tipsy revelers on the make, and a small cocktail dining area at the edge of an absolutely mobbed dance floor. I had hoped there would be a sign at the entrance announcing a stage hypnotist for the evening, but there was no such thing in sight. Half of the effectiveness of a stage hypnotist, I think, is the eager anticipation of the audience that they're going to see a hypnotist. That expectation alone will set up a certain percentage to go right into a hypnotic state, or at least to play along. But these people aren't here to get hypnotized. They're here for the, mating ritual, shall we say. I barely have a chance to take all this in when the band takes its break with the announcement, "And now, here's the amazing Whitman!" Oh my God, I step up and take the microphone. Even with the microphone, it's hard to make myself heard over the din at the two bars. "Attention, everyone! May I have your attention?" "Yeah, everyone at the bar, may I have your attention?" This ploy is only semi-effective and hardly lays the groundwork for the rapport I hope to establish. Now, mind you, I'm trying to wing it. I have no prepared script that I've memorized, which I'm sure is what all the professionals do. So my opening patter is somewhat halting and lame. I'm addressing myself primarily to the diners, since they are at least at tables facing me and reasonably attentive, despite all the noise coming from the bar. I ask them to pick up a fork and hold it at arm's length, then suggest that the fork will get heavier and heavier and their grip on it weaker and weaker until the fork falls to the floor. Thankfully, forks actually do start audibly hitting the floor. I invite a number of the fork droppers to join me up at the mic. It takes some coaxing, but finally I have five or six up there with me. I do my hypnotic induction, and they seem only modestly responsive, but I press on anyway. It's particularly painful, however, when I suggest they each have a parrot on their arm, and one pipes up, "Parrot? What parrot? I don't see a parrot." And so it goes downhill from there, until finally this most painful and embarrassing ordeal is over. I hand the mic over to the lead rocker as I walk off. "Hey, everybody, let's have a hand for the amazing Whitman." I feel so humiliated, I can barely look anyone in the eye. But one of the hypnotic volunteers comes up and says, "Hey, man, I'm really sorry. You really had me going under, but it just felt so noisy and unsafe in here that I pulled myself out." I see the guy who had given me my ride earlier that day. He's with his girlfriend, as promised. They try to be reassuring. I start tossing down a succession of very stiff drinks and proceed to get very drunk. As I'm toddling off to my room, I see Rocco with a group at a table, and he motions me over.
"Hey, Whitman, not bad. Wasn't an ideal environment, but you got potential. You should come around and see me tomorrow, and I'll make some calls."
Next day, Rocco says, in fact, he can put me in a club for the 4th of July, which is a week or so away. I decline. I've got a plane back to California the next day. What can I say? The Valium made me do it. But this is not the end of my brief and tragic career as a stage hypnotist. Oh, no. But that's a different story. If you beg and plead, I might share it with you in a subsequent episode.
The Amazing Whitman.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out, Shrink Wrap Radio, shrinkwrapradio.com.
Thank you, Adam Curry, for that endorsement on the Daily Source Code. We call Adam the Podfather because without him, there would be no podcasting as we know it. Adam would also like me to remind you that you can get a great discount on your next domain name by using Shrink3 at checkout on GoDaddy.com. Let me know if you like these personal stories like The Amazing Whitman and the one on the previous show about my first job out of college in advertising, or if you find them too self-indulgent, or any other reactions you might have. We have some new additions to our Frapper map that shows where listeners are located. We have Sarah in Normandy, France, who would really like some help with learning English. Well, Sarah, if you continue to listen to this show, maybe you'll pick up more and more English. We have David in Silver Lake, North Carolina, Elena in Austin, Texas, Mike H. in Cape Town, Western Cape Town, South Africa. We have Dawn in Kansas City, Sylvia in Los Angeles, Anna in Peoria, Illinois, and Brandon in Traverse City, Michigan. Now, don't forget you can win a free autographed copy of the book I co-authored in which I profile the infamous Zodiac serial killer. All you have to do to enter is put yourself on our Frapper map by going to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Also, drop me an email if you're at all interested in attending the workshop I'll be co-leading in Tuscany, Italy, from September 18 to 24. Be sure to do that right away because time is running out.
Dr. Dave, hi. It's Mike here from Cape Town, South Africa. I've really been enjoying your show, been listening to it for a few months now. Taking me some time to get through all your archive pods. But your podcasts, but really enjoying it. Keep up the good work and looking forward to hearing many more. Take care.
Mike, thanks very much for that voice message, which I was pleased to find in my Skype voicemail box. I'd love to get more voicemails like this from listeners. You can do it right on our site using MyChingo, or you can send me an MP3 or leave it as a message on Skype, which is what Mike did. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name there is ShrinkPod. You can also leave live messages right on the website at shrinkwrapradio.com if you have a mic hooked up to your computer. Just look for the bright green My Chingo logo on the left side of the page and click on that. Now, on to some of the recent emails from listeners. First of all, you may recall Muhammad, our listener in Baghdad, who I interviewed on an earlier show. With all the escalating violence there, I wrote to Mo, concerned for his safety. I'm happy to say I got an email right back. He writes, "Hey Doc, I'm fine, thanks for asking. The situation is getting worse. There have been many explosions and confrontations in my neighborhood and in many others that were relatively safer before. But I'm still in one piece. I don't go to internet cafes much. My home internet is better now, and it provides me with online access most of the day, except for when the power problems renders it useless. I have a new laptop and a good mic from which I can record better quality voicemail updates, but I don't know what to talk about. I wanted so much to comment on your dream of several shows back about the broken lawnmower, but I couldn't find resources to support what I remember about an Islamic theory that classifies the things we see in our dreams. Your show keeps getting better. My favorite part is when you read the mail and comment on your listeners' letters. I like the new intro music. Keep up the great work, Doc. Mo." Muhammad, I'm so glad that you continue to be safe. We're all praying for an end to this conflict. If you can find that Islamic dream resource, I'd be curious to know what it has to say about my lawnmower dream, which I've since forgotten. I guess I'll have to go back and listen to the shows to bring it back. Unfortunately, there is now a war raging between Israel and the Hezbollah in Lebanon. I've asked Israeli listener Cody, whose emails I've read previously, if she can connect me to a psychologist in Israel to comment on how people are coping psychologically there. She's given me the phone number of a psychologist radio personality there, and I'll see what I can line up. Thanks for your help with that, Cody. We have another one who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, Sylvia here, newbie from L.A. via Italy. Love the shows. Thanks for trying to improve the technology. Some shows were too unbalanced between the host and the interviewee's volume. Tried Chingo, but didn't work. Keep up the good work, Sylvia." Yes, Sylvia, I keep struggling with the technology, and hopefully, eventually, I will get it down and it will all be perfect. And I'm sorry to hear that my Chingo didn't work for you. I think it may require that you have Java installed on your computer. Listener Mark H. writes, "I've only recently started to listen to your podcast, and I wanted to express my appreciation to you for the service. It's evident that a lot of work goes into each podcast. I would guess that each podcast reflects probably 6 to 10 hours of work." That's very true, Mark. "My background, I am one of these people who took a bunch of psychology courses, but I never took a course in history and systems, and I'm now beyond that. Can you recommend some reading? I've recently become interested in Jungian theory, but I find Jung difficult to read." Indeed, he can be very challenging. "Over the past several years, I've read a lot by James Hillman, a neo-Jungian, and Thomas More. However, is there somebody else you could recommend? Bear in mind that I'm interested in something a little more than general. This might be a daunting task because Jung was interested in everything from shamans to mandalas to art and the myths we live by. I would like to start with the shadow, the animus and anima, and dreams." And then he signs it, Mark H. Well, Mark, anybody who's reading Thomas More and particularly James Hillman is certainly not a novice to the field. And there might be some books by Jung that you could tackle. If you haven't already read Man and His Symbols or Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, I would certainly recommend those two. Also, I found June Singer's Boundaries of the Soul really opened up the whole Jungian world very clearly for me. Mark, I wonder if you've read anything by Robert Johnson. I would recommend two books by him. One is titled She, and is about the anima, and the other is titled He, and is about the animus. You won't go wrong with either of these two books. There's now yet a new way to access Shrink Wrap Radio. You can do so by going to shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com. The Podshow site has a number of features designed to help you subscribe to your favorite podcasts. There's even a place where you can leave your reviews of Shrink Wrap Radio. I hope you'll leave some of the good comments you've sent by email there so that others might be attracted to the show. Please help spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. If you've got a podcast or a blog or a MySpace or a LinkedIn page, we'd certainly appreciate a plug there. Thanks to April Fresh Goddess, who left a good review of Shrink Wrap Radio on her MySpace site. And to wrap things up, thanks again to Dr. Padma Cottrell for the interview on psychotherapy and drugs. Lately, I've received some requests for coverage of traditional diagnostic categories. To honor these, our next show will feature a return of Dr. Maria Hess, who teaches psychopathology. We will be discussing the narcissistic personality disorder. Thanks to Canadian Pierre Journel, who provided the jazz track behind my Amazing Whitman story. You'll find Pierre on the PodSafe Music Network. Apropos of Dr. Cottrell's discussion of combining psychotherapy and medication for the treatment of depression, it only seems appropriate to close with a blues number titled The Road by P.W. Fenton and the Second Ward. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Have you ever got the blues? Make you wanna hit the road and ride? Have you ever got the blues? Make you wanna hit the road and ride? Turn that radio up loud. Watch the world pass by outside. All behind. Have you ever been inclined to leave your troubles all behind? Put your back to where you've been and turn your eyes to what you'll find. Keep turning under me. On the road, just keep turning under me. When that sun comes up tomorrow, I wonder where I will be. We'll be right back. watch the world pass by outside. Have you ever been inclined to leave your troubles all behind? Have you ever been inclined to leave your troubles all behind? Put your back to where you've been.